Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, actress Alexandra Tidings, that's coming up on Endeavors. Indecision keeps me up now. Need another place to mind my mind. Give a little bit of God to sin. Keeping safe is keeping you away. Hercules, Xena, Warrior Princess. The latter show in particular was an icon of late 90s pop culture and was one of the first sex symbols for queer young women everywhere. My guest today spent many years in a recurring role on both shows as the Greek goddess Aphrodite. She's also been seen on Party of Five, The Red Shoe Diaries, The Wire, and as Woody Harrelson's wife in The Sun Chaser, which was her first feature film. Her latest project is the horror thriller What Death Leaves Behind. She is also a writer and director in her own right and created an award-winning play at the Charm City Fringe Festival and has written and directed a short film, Rainbow Bridge. She is Alexandra Tidings, and I spoke with her just yesterday. Alexandra Tidings, hello, good afternoon. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much, it's a pleasure.
So you're part of a new film, What Death Leaves Behind. How did this project come about for you?
For me, it came completely out of the blue. I think this is one of the only times I've been cast without auditioning, which is my favorite way to be cast. No offense to, you know, the audition process, but it's my favorite thing in the world. I know one of the producers randomly through my daughter's school, and we've known each other for years, and he called me one day. I had no idea he was making a movie. I had no idea anything about the project, and he just called me and said, "We'd like to offer you this role," and then told me a little bit about the movie, and, you know, as soon as I heard about it, I was on.
Are you...
That was it. It was pretty easy. It was pretty fun.
Would you call yourself a fan of sort of the horror thriller genre?
I would call myself fan adjacent, which is to say that I have been a long-time lover of all things cult and cult-related, and also gothic, sort of vampire-related. But truth be told, I get really scared in horror movies. I told the producers, I don't know, I'll come to the premiere and I'll do the red carpet stuff, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to sit through the movie. I might have nightmares afterwards. And you know what? It turned out it was fine. And I made it through. I made it through just fine without too many horrible dreams. But funny little story, my first cousin, Warrington Gillette, played Jason in Friday the 13th Part 2. And, you know, which is a big, big deal when he got that part. And I was a little girl, and we were so excited for him that, you know, we all went to see the movie in the movie theaters, and I think I was 8 or something. I think I was in second grade. I was tiny. And it sort of traumatized me for life. Like, I can't really be out in nature for very long without getting pretty frightened. I mean, my first response is fear when I hear, like, crickets chirping or see a lovely, calm, placid lake. So it's been hard for me to really get into the horror genre, although I like the community. I like the fans. I like the cult world. I get nightmares, is the truth.
Now, is it true that this film went to Sundance earlier this year?
It did, yes, it did. It screened at Sundance. I didn't get to go, but a lot of the cast got to go. You can find them. You can You can find those pictures on the internet, I'm sure. And they had a great time. It's already, you know, had a really good little festival run. It's picked up a lot of awards. I think it's something that everyone can be proud of.
At first glance, it might not be, when you think of Sundance, you may not necessarily think of a film like this. But from your experience as an actor and as a filmmaker, what do you think the misconception about Sundance or any type of festival is?
You know, I think probably a filmmaker or a producer might be able to tell you to answer that better than I could. But I think, you know, they're kind of industry events. I remember way back when I came out of college and I had studied film, and a lot of my film school friends were trying to break into the independent movie industry. Like, that's where you went to, if you had a little movie that you somehow cobbled together the money to make, that's where you went to sell it. Like, that's where you went to find a distributor. And the world is so different now, especially with, you know, so many different ways of screening things and video on demand and Netflix and Amazon and all of that. I think the distribution end of things is quite different than it used to be. It used to be that you were just trying to get your movie into a few art house, you know, theaters that would pick it up and show it. But I think it still has those roots in, you know, kind of, it's like a convention for filmmakers and a place where people come together to see new work and celebrate work. And somewhere along the line, it became very glamorous, and I think some of the bigger production houses realized it was a great place to do a lot of marketing, and that's when it became more of a red carpet event. But I think it still really has its roots in independent filmmaking and people sharing their work, you know, sort of their hopes and dreams with other crazy artists who are loony enough to try to do this thing. And I think that's kind of wonderful. And I do think maybe there's still a possibility for some little, you know, little engine that could to find its, you know, find its spot. I mean, the fact that they still show short films in a lot of festivals is maybe a sign to that. Although I guess things are changing now, and short films are starting to have a life on the internet. So who knows?
You mentioned streaming and sort of how everything's evolved in the last 5 or 10 years. Does that make it easier or harder to get a film seen?
Oh, that's so interesting. I think, I don't know, maybe both. I know that to get a big budget movie, from what I've heard, you really have to be able to sell it overseas in multiple markets to, you know, foreign audiences that have millions of viewers. So to find an audience that's that big, you're going to really need to find something that appeals to a huge swath of people, and that's why we have so many comic book movies and movies that have, you know, kind of a licensed history behind it, something that Stan Lee was behind, or Marvel Comics or DC or something. Which I think has actually turned out to be wonderful. I mean, Black Panther was amazing, and Wonder Woman was fabulous, and I think they're doing really, really cool stuff. But for the smaller weirdo films that don't come with such a pedigree, I think it's nice that there's so many little ways of. I mean, you could even make your thing and put it up on YouTube. The problem is, how do people make a living? You know, and musicians have a lot to say about that, because, you know, the music industry has really suffered so much because of the ability to put songs up on the internet. In some ways it's easier for a new artist to get a break because it's easier for them to get heard, but in terms of people who, you know, a musician who graduated from Juilliard and has student loans to pay back, that's going to be tough. There's not sort of the same kind of reliable career, I think, that there used to be, and that's probably happening to the film as well. So it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, I'm a mom, and I tell my children, any tool, you know, they're using their cell phones, and I'm trying to parent that, which is challenging. But I keep coming back around to any tool is it depends on how you use it. You know, gunpowder could kill people, or it could be beautiful fireworks in the sky. What are you going to do with it? And I think the internet's the same thing.
And I'm
but
sure
in terms
you...
of its potential for maybe being able to be something creative and new, I think that's definitely there.
And I'm curious maybe how much you learned about the process and the industry when you made your own film.
Yeah, well, I you mean as a director?
Yeah, Rainbow Bridge.
Yes, I learned a lot. So Rainbow Bridge was a short film that I wrote and directed, and it's being edited now. I'm not quite sure where they are in the process, and hopefully at some point it'll be released and the world will see it. So that's a short. That's one place where, yeah, where it would be great to be able to get it into little festivals, and I'm so grateful that, you know, festivals, even big festivals, will show short films. I learned so much. As I said, I studied film in college. I did a lot of performing when I was younger, but then when I was in college, I studied filmmaking and film theory and other sort of adjacent theories that went along with it, feminist theory and psychoanalytic theory and all kinds of stuff. And I performed mostly in bands when I was in college and a little bit in other people's movies, which is how I ended up coming back around to acting, because I had so much fun being in other people's movies that I remembered that I liked to do that and decided to come back around to it. But I learned a lot about filmmaking back then when film was actually shot on film and not on video. And it's changed a lot over the years. And most of it I've seen from the side of the actor, from in front of the camera. But I was always curious. And even one time on set, I think it was on Xena, they let me run the camera for one shot. Shh, don't tell the producers. Which was so fun. And somewhere there's a picture of me behind this giant camera rig. Now the camera rigs are a lot smaller, and now the the whole apparatus is so much smaller because of video, and so it can go a lot faster, and you can be a lot more nimble, and get a lot more done, and you can also shoot for a lot less money, which is huge, especially for young or independent new people getting into the industry. So, my chance to get behind the camera as a director, I got to see a lot of that stuff, which was just fascinating, a huge learning curve, and really, really interesting.
You know, you alluded to it just there. We mentioned sort of cult films earlier and the big fan-based films, and we just had Fan Expo here in Toronto. I got to ask you about your experience working on both Hercules and Xena as the mighty Aphrodite.
Yes, that was a really fun job. That was a wonderful 6 years of my life. I just loved it. You know, when I did the first, I was cast on Hercules first, and I had never seen the show, and I got the script, and I read it, and I was completely confused, because I grew up, I didn't really watch very much of the, you know, sort of the classics, but I had a picture in my head of, sort of Greek, you know, somber Greek people in long flowing white things walking around, you know, pronouncements. And I got this script and I read it, and I think Aphrodite's first line in the first episode is tubular. So I called my agents and I said, I'm so confused. Is this a comedy? Is this a half hour show with a live studio audience? I'm totally confused. And my agent turns out to be a huge Hercules fan, and she said, it's campy, which is my favorite word. I grew up in D.C., so John Waters is a huge hero of mine. So anything camp is right up my alley. She said, it's campy, it's silly and fun. Just go in and have fun with it. So I took it from there and took off running. It was a really, really fun show. And I thought I was just going to do one episode, and then they brought me back again, and then they brought me over to Xena, and then we did all kinds of crazy things. The great thing about that genre, what I learned was fantasy genre, is that the writers can be so loose with what they're able to do, because you can have alternate universes, you can have, you know, crazy dream sequences, you can have monsters put spells on people and have them act in crazy different ways. So I got to, you know, one episode I got to wear a little mini Hercules outfit and you know, try my hand at a bow and arrow. And another one, there was an alternate universe where Aphrodite wore all black. It was very serious and somber. So it was just tremendous fun and such a great group of people to work with. And New Zealand is really one of the most extraordinary places in the world. I highly recommend it.
I think Xena particularly still has a life of its own and sort of has moved beyond whatever it was when it was on television into something else. What did that show mean to you, and why is it still so relevant in today's day and age?
I think it's so relevant today because it was really one of the first gay icon shows for women. One of the first lesbian icons was Xena. I can't think of anybody before that. I mean, maybe Linda Carter and Wonder Woman, but not really. I mean, they really leaned into it with the relationship between Xena and Gabrielle. And I kind of remember vaguely hearing about it early on in my time on the show. Oh, this is becoming a cult classic with the lesbians. And I was like, really? And then there was an episode where they were in the bathtub together and clearly the writers were having a fun time with it. Clearly the producers were letting it happen. I mean, it was in the 90s and it was all subtext. Nothing was ever, you know, no one ever said these women are lovers or, you know, nothing like that ever happened. And I think that may have been a frustration for some people in the audience, but really nothing really ever had at that point. That was before we had Queer as Folk or Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or The L Word or any of those shows. So I think it was a big deal. And I know that a lot of women formed friendships around that show. And I can imagine, I'm queer and I was the queer community when I was in college was a big part of my life. And I can totally imagine, you know, getting together with all my friends on a Sunday night to watch the show. I don't know if that's what happened, but I imagine that's what happened. And I can imagine it being pretty important if you were coming out in the context of that. That's my guess. Also, you know, Charlie's Angels was awesome. That was on when I was a kid. I loved that show, but there was always Charlie, even though we never saw him, there was always Charlie calling the shots and telling the women what to do. Xena, and then there was Linda Carter as Wonder Woman, but other than that, I guess the Bionic Woman, I was so young then, I can't really remember. At any rate, Xena was one of the first female characters I remember, like, strong action character who didn't have a man telling her what to do, and she really had, like, no man in the world was going to tell her what to do. And she was a badass. I think that's why she still resonates with people.
You know, I think between horror and then the fantasy sci-fi genres, it seems like those two genres are always the first to push some sort of, or make their project with some sort of social justice bent or some sort of advancement in human rights, or, you know, in Xena's case it was the queer thing. Why
right.
do you think
or feminism also, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Why do you think those genres are so good at promoting those types of ideals as opposed to a straight comedy or a straight drama?
Interesting that you just said that. I've never thought about that before, and I want to reserve the right to reflect on it a little more before I completely jump in and agree with you, but I think, yeah, you're onto something, because, right, the first interracial kiss was on Star Trek, right? Do you know?
Yeah.
That's my understanding. So, yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, I'm gonna hypothesize, having never reflected on this before and being not 100% sure that you're right, although thinking that you probably are. I have two things I would maybe. What do you think about these? One is the writers are operating in the world of fantasy, so they can imagine anything. So they can kind of imagine a world where we can have an interracial couple and that's okay, or a world where we can have two women who are lovers and that's okay, because they get to, you know, expand their mind into any kind of reality that they want to, so they can, so they're at liberty to imagine that. That's hypothesis number one. Hypothesis number two is that I am certainly a geek, a nerd. I already told you I'm queer. Like, I come from that world. I was, you know, goth and punk in high school, and certainly part of the freaks and geeks edge of things. So I mean it with great love when I say those genres tend to attract the nerds, right? Like, that's the stuff that we like. And a lot of the nerds are gay or are weird or are in some ways kind of like don't fit into whatever it is that we thought we were supposed to be when we were in high school. So you know, if you take somebody who's already marginalized and give them the liberty to fantasize whatever they want to, maybe they're more likely to come up with a world where it's a little more fair, where people who are a little different are okay. I don't know. What do you think? Those are my two first thoughts. What do you think?
Well, what you just said, it reminds me, it's like giving power to the little guy.
Yeah. Exactly.
Giving power to those who otherwise may not have a voice.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I mean, I've done Fan Expo for a couple of years, and that's what I get out of it for sure.
Yeah, and I haven't been to a convention in a few years, but especially the really big ones. Like, I remember Dragon Con a while ago. It was just. And also the big Xena conventions, too. Like, just the exuberance and joy and fun of so many people kind of finding their tribe, finally. It's like we were all ugly ducklings our whole entire life, and then finally we found all this one. And finally, like, oh, these are my people. Oh, I get it. And here we are, and we're all together. And we can, like, hang out together and have fun, and, you know. And the internet allowed that, you know, much more easily, too.
I know that Xena was shot in New Zealand, and of course New Zealand being famous for Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and other films and series of that ilk. What is it about New Zealand and that landscape and that terrain that lends itself so well to shooting these type of fantasy epics?
A few things. First of all, it's so beautiful. It's really just gorgeous. Gorgeous. Gorgeousness. I think also, I don't know if this is true, but this is what I heard. So hearsay, take it with a grain of salt. I think in the 90s, which is when Hercules and Xena were shooting, I think they offered some pretty good tax breaks as incentives to production companies shooting down there. I think Canada did the same thing. So at the same time, there are a lot of shows going up to Canada. So I think because of that, it was just simply cheaper to shoot there. Also, at some point, the economy in the Pacific Rim took a big hit, and it made the dollar a lot stronger. So your dollar went further when you were down there. Which was great for us and terrible for them, but made shooting down there a lot cheaper. So I think that's a huge reason why, because filming is so expensive, and they need to do everything they can. And also, the cheaper you can shoot, then the more you can put money on the frame, and you can, you know, have a higher production value. And then also with The Hobbit, Peter Jackson who directed those movies, is from New Zealand. He's from there. You know, he made. A lot of great movies before then too, and Heavenly Creatures was one of the first, and that's a drama about two teenage girls, but they had this fantasy life with these crazy characters, and I think they were claymation. Do you remember? Did you see that movie?
Yeah, the one with Kate Winslet and
Kate Winslet,
Melanie Lynskey. Yeah,
young, like teenage Kate Winslet was amazing. So do you remember the special effects in that? What was that? Was that claymation or something? Those crazy creatures?
Yeah, I mean, that's, well, I mean, that's how Peter Jackson started, right, was in effects.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he had the Way to Workshop, and then he did, like, he did The Frighteners, was very similar to that, and...
Right, exactly. So what was happening with all of that is he was essentially creating a whole world of special effects artists down in New Zealand, including some of the people that we worked with in Xena. They stole them from us. You know, like, one of my best friends was my makeup artist when I first started on Hercules, and then she went over to Xena, and then she slowly started doing more and more special effects stuff, and then she really, special effects is so fun, so then she started getting really into it, and she ended up leaving with a whole lot of the rest of the crew to go do the Lord of the Rings movies, and I got to go down and visit them. I mean, that was just so for a special effects artist in a tiny little country, the population of which is like a third of New York City, to be able to work on these amazing movies, creating Gandalf's nose and hobbit feet and elf ears and all that, is pretty amazing. And I think Peter Jackson honestly had a lot to do with it. Starting, you mentioned his company, Weta, and exactly, they grew it up through The Frighteners and then on to the other movies. So I think that has a lot to do with it, too. I mean, if I was going to make a big special effects movie, I'd want those guys doing it, for sure. No place in the world is this. Every place in the world is gorgeous and beautiful, but no place looks like it's extraordinary.
Do you think, while we're on the topic of fantasy, do you think Lord of the Rings sort of made that genre acceptable for a mainstream audience?
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, maybe. I think... I haven't thought about this, but I think it was a few different... It all sort of seemed to happen around the same time, didn't it? Like, so many more Star Wars series happened. Like, there was the first one, and there was another one, and then all of a sudden there were, like, lots of them, and Xena and Lord of the Rings and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and all of this stuff suddenly sort of went from being something that, someone might not really fess up to loving to something that everybody loved and was mainstream cool. I think the internet probably had a lot to do with it. I think in some ways you could see the tech revolution is like the revenge of the nerds period of our history, where kids who had been like computer geeks and nerds were suddenly becoming millionaires and developing things that were culturally really, really, really important, and then also finding their community online and finding lots of other people who like the same stuff and all of that, which probably led the way to the comic book movies today too, right?
For sure.
What do you think?
Yeah. We've talked a lot about fantasy, but you've done a lot more work in television than I think people realize. And you've been on a show, I know you're only on one episode, but it's been called one of the greatest TV series ever made. And I speak, of course, of The Wire.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. That must have been something else.
That was something else. Full disclosure, it's like a blink and you miss it, tiny little part. But yeah, it's a great show. It's, again, remember we started off that this whole conversation talking about how I get nightmares. So I've actually had a really hard time. I haven't been able to watch the whole series because it's dark and it's really upsetting, but it's beautifully written and beautifully acted and beautifully made. And I admire those guys so much. It's also made in Baltimore, which, props to Baltimore. It's one of the greatest cities, and it's right up the street from where I grew up. So that was amazing. And I had taken a bunch of time off. I had had two babies and taken a bunch of time off just to, be pregnant and be a mom and stuff like that. And I was sort of dipping my toe back into the world and seeing if I could be a mom and be an actress, and I got that job, and it was just so interesting and so fun. They shot it in a suburb outside of Baltimore, and my episode is in season 5, which is the season that was all about the Baltimore Sun, which I think is so interesting. And so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't some of the rougher stuff and any of the street stuff or any of that, but, and I played an editor, on the Baltimore Sun editorial board. And, so I, you know, drove out there and showed up and they put me in my trailer and I didn't know anyone. And then they brought me in to set up the shot, me and I'm in the scene with a bunch of other actors. And we're all sitting around a table and, you know, in the Baltimore Sun offices, it's an editorial board and there's a scene where we're all talking about what's going to go on the cover of each section of the paper. And usually it had been, as I said, it had been several years since I'd worked. And in the past, it was one of the first times I ever worked on video. And in the past, they would bring you in and they'd line you up and the director of photography would look through the camera and see how the lights were looking and see how, you know, make sure everyone was lit well. And then they'd send you away and you'd go away sometimes for a few hours while they lit everything. But this time they were ready to go. So, so that was a little bit of a surprise. I mean, it's totally fine, but different. They were ready to go. And so we did the scene and that was great. And everybody had lots of different actors, had lots of different lines. And what happens when you're shooting, let's say like a traditional scene between two people. So half of the scene, you're going to see, maybe you'll see an establishing shot, a wider shot with the two of them in the same frame, in the same image. And then you're going to see over the shoulder of one person with a close over of the other person, and over the shoulder in the other direction. And so when you're shooting it, the camera's going to move like 180 degrees. It's going to move all the way from one side of the room to the other side of the room. And one side of it, they're going to see your face, and the other side of it, they're going to see the back of your head or over your shoulder or what would be over your shoulder from your point of view. So the lights have to completely change. And usually that was like a 2 or 3 hour process. You know, you'd shoot one half of the film, of the scene, and then you'd go away, and then you'd be called back like 2 or 3 hours later, and you'd shoot the other half from the other side. And that didn't happen. It was the first time this has ever happened for me. They did it, and then they were going to turn around. That's what they call it. And they didn't. They had us just like get a cup of coffee and then sit back down. And I was like, wait, I thought you guys were turning around. And they were like, we are. We did. And I was like, well, where are all the lights? And they were like, oh, we because everything is digital. They used special digital lights up in. We were shooting in like an office park, and so it felt like the actual what actually might be Baltimore Sun offices. I don't know what Baltimore Sun offices look like, but if they were in an office park, it felt like that. And they were using special film grade lights inside the regular office park lights. And so when they turned around, they didn't have to change anything. And they had done all of this lighting at the beginning of the series because they knew they were going to shoot there and this was going to be the Baltimore Sun offices all through the whole series. Not the whole series, this the whole season. And so they just were ready to go and we shot the scene and then we were done, which, I mean, that scene with that many actors would have taken at least a whole day in the old days. That really opened my eyes. I was stunned. And time is so much money when you think about how many people are working on one shot. You know, you've got 40 people, all of them, you know, paying the bills and so time is really, really, really costly. That was amazing to me. That was a whole new world when I saw that.
You know, not only has The Wire become ingrained, I think, into pop culture, but it's also given an identity to Baltimore. And you also mentioned John Waters, who I loved, who's also from Baltimore. And there are these two sides. If you had to describe Baltimore, how would you describe it?
Ooh, that's interesting. You know, the man in the White House has said some very disparaging things about Baltimore lately. So I want to tread lightly here because I have so much admiration and respect for people in Baltimore. I think Baltimore is a fabulous city. As I said, I grew up in D.C. and Baltimore was always kind of like a cooler, hipper place to be. And I remember there was one nightclub that was open in Baltimore that it didn't open until midnight. And so the effort we had to go through to get there, to get somebody with a car to drive us there at midnight and then drive us back in the wee hours of the morning, and oh my God, but it was so worth it because it was the best, it was the best music, it was the best dancing, and we made friends there. There's a really good art school there called Maryland Institute College of Art, props to Micah, that has always had such interesting people and such cool, just such cool stuff happening, and they do really interesting things in the community, and as a result, it's just a very, very vibrant, creative, funky place. I think it's no surprise at all that John Waters came from there. Is there poverty? Yes. Is it a problem? Yes. You know, is that true of lots of places in this country, including, you know, rural towns? Yes. We need to do a much better job of figuring that stuff out. But Baltimore's an awesome place. I really, really like it. I had the honor of putting on a play there a few years ago at the Charm City Fringe Festival, and just fell in love with that city all over again. It's so quirky and weird and fun. I don't know much about, you know, rough street culture, drug culture, all that stuff from The Wire. Thankfully, I don't know much about that stuff firsthand. I believe that they were probably, you know, did their research and got that stuff right, unfortunately. But I think that's probably true of most cities in this country.
What is your favorite John Waters film?
Ah! Oh, my God. Well, okay, so it's been decades since I've watched one. So I want to go back and watch again. You know, I kind of have to say Hairspray. I think I have to say Hairspray, even though there's so many really good ones with Divine from earlier that were so fabulous and ridiculous. But Hairspray was just so joyful and fun. And also I knew one of the dancers in it. A friend of mine was in that big, huge, giant dance scene at the beginning. Is it at the beginning? I can't remember. Where they all do the same dance. God, it's been so long. My kids are going to be really embarrassed that I can't remember the name of the song or any of it. But yeah, so that was just, I was like living vicariously through him. And thought it was the coolest thing ever. Plus, Debbie Harry is one of my all-time favorite anything ever. And Blondie, I think Blondie was the second album I ever bought somehow magically when I was a little kid. I just loved, loved, loved her. So for all those reasons, I'm going to say Hairspray.
There's a few other projects that I was interested in asking you about. We've talked about your work on television, and I know one of your very first gigs was working on another cult show, The Red Shoe Diaries. I know you did two episodes of that. What was that experience like for you, especially as a young actress at the time?
Oh my God, I have so much compassion for myself when I think about that. I was 22. I just graduated from college, and as I said, I kind of grew up in watching cult movies and listening to punk music and goth music and watching European movies. Betty Blue was one of my favorite movies. Weird, you know, culty independent movies. Blue Velvet was one of my favorite movies. When my agent called me, they first called me. Zalman King, who's the executive producer of Red Shoe Diaries, was making, he was directing a film called Delta of Venus, which was based on the life of Anais Nin. And for any of your listeners who don't know who that is, she's an amazing writer. She's a really, really interesting character. She had a long relationship with Henry Miller, who's also a really interesting writer of mid-20th century. And she really had an amazing voice and wrote a lot of very personal essays, and her diaries were published, but she also wrote short stories, I think, and a lot of sort of erotic stuff, which as a sort of young, maybe gay or queer or bisexual, not quite sure, teenager, like that was all very interesting to me. So when my agent called me, I had been in LA for like 5 minutes. I mean, really, I didn't even have my SAG card yet, my union. I wasn't a member of the union yet. And my agent said, now, I don't know if you're going to want to do this because there's nudity in it. And, you know, my ears pricked up and I was kind of like, well, what is it? And he said, it's called the Delta of Venus. And I was like, what? Is It About an Ice Man? Oh my God, I love her. So I went into audition for that. They brought me back so many times. They auditioned me again and again and again and again. I really wanted the part. They were filming it in Prague. I really wanted to go to Prague. I didn't get it. But then they offered me Reggie Diaries. They didn't even have me read for it. They just offered it to me. And at that point, by that point, I had kind of wrapped my head around doing nudity and figured out that I was fine with that. I mean, Betty Blue was one of my favorite movies ever. And the first scene of the whole entire film is a sex scene. And I don't have like morality issues about that stuff. I also have to say I was very naive at the time about how something like that might be exploited down the road. I also didn't know that the internet was going to keep these images alive for decades. I don't think my children have found them yet. I hope they don't. Whatever, I'll deal with it. But I certainly didn't have shame about it, and I really, really wanted to work. And so then they offered me Wretched Diaries, and I said, okay. And I remember somebody saying, like, do you want to take a look at that? It's not a movie. It's not the Anna Eastman movie. It's something different. It's a TV show. Do you want to see? And I was like, nah, I'm cool. So I did it. And, you know, I still don't have shame about it. But I do, I wish I had kind of known Eyes Wide Open a little bit better what I was getting into before I did it. Honestly, between you and me, I mean, I was 22 years old and I really wanted to work. I probably would have done it again. But I'll tell you that the jobs I got after that over and over and over again, it was like, you know, there was nudity involved. It was kind of, I don't want to say trashy. It was, I passed on that stuff, you know, and so I sort of had to, I suppose there's a really good interview. You can find it on YouTube with Denzel Washington, where he talks about one of the first movies he was offered was kind of exploitative and kind of ugly ghetto stuff where people just keep getting murdered, and he passed on it because he didn't want that to be the sort of the direction that launched his career. And if someone had framed it to me that way, I might have passed on that job, but I didn't. Whatever, it's out there. All the world can see me in lots of sex scenes in those shows. And I, you know, it's a good way to get over nerves. I'll tell you that. Doing sex scenes and singing, those are the two fastest ways to get over yourself if you're nervous about being on TV.
Is it hard to portray nudity right in films? Like, is it sometimes let's just make the naked for the sake of it?
I think there's a lot of that. I think there's a ton of that. And I think there's a lot of that. I think that's true of violence also, and blood too. And I want us to be careful about that stuff. I want us to be, I want us to have our eyes wide open, and I want us to think about it, you know, and we have such a different perspective on those kinds of issues today than we did, you know, 20 years ago. It's pretty remarkable. And so I watch my children, you know, I have two teenage daughters now, and I watch TV with them sometimes, or sometimes some old movie will come up, and it's really surprising how different things seem to us. Like, we were watching Gilmore Girls, which I love and they love, and it's a, you know, it's a nice, sweet family show. It's good for moms and girls. They're good role models. Nobody's doing drugs. You know, it's a sweet show. But at one point, one of my kids turned to me and said, "Mommy, are there no black people in this town?" And I was like, "Oh my God, you're right. Yeah, no, it doesn't. It appears that there are no black people in this town." You know, and it's something I don't think anybody thought about. Or no, I think a lot fewer people thought about it when the show came out than they do today. Or, you know, some whatever, Friends or something that we thought was totally normal. I think The Breakfast Club, is that the one where there's a scene where he's like looking up her skirt and she doesn't know it? And when it came out, everybody kind of thought that was funny. And now we watch it and we think it's kind of cringy. It's really interesting how much our perspective on things has shifted, how much homophobia you could how many homophobic jokes you could get away with in a mainstream show, even maybe 10 years ago, that you can't, you know, you'd see two straight guys having kind of a moment of affection and like almost hugging each other and then going like, okay, okay, enough of that. You know, and my kids will turn to me and be like, is that a homophobic joke, Mom? And like, yeah, it is, actually. And nobody cared enough to say anything when they were making it, but we care now. We see it and we kind of cringe. So I think that's certainly, you know, we have a different perspective looking back on that stuff. I haven't watched those shows in a very, very long time, so I shudder to think how I would feel about it now if I saw them. Nah, that's silly. I'm proud of it. I got my SAG card and I got my first job acting. But I do think we need to, and I think we are, thinking more carefully about, you know, representation is important. At the same time, I've mentioned shame a few times, and that's an important piece too, I think, and kind of not shaming women for their sexuality or not shaming women for having sex and all of that. It's a tricky tightrope to walk, and it's something I'm really interested in my own work, in my own writing and directing. Is trying to open up more a world for girls and women that has more freedom and without being exploited or abused. I think that's a really interesting area, especially right now.
And you actually got to, I know you have kids now, where we're talking a lot about 90s TV shows. You got to experience your own teen drama when you guest starred in Party of Five. What do you remember about that show?
That was another really fun show. I played a date. I was Charlie's date, and he was just beginning to think about dating again, and he had a couple of bad dates. I think I was the last bad date he had, and they got progressively slightly better, or they were bad and bad, and then I was the one that was like, oh, maybe this is going to work. And then at the end of the date, he walks me home, and clearly we've had a fun time together, and there's even a little short kiss, but then he wants to come upstairs, and I say no, and it's an awkward moment, and so I finally confess, my character confesses that she has twin babies upstairs sleeping, her own children. And he just looks at her like, you're kidding me. And that's the end of their budding romance. He's like, that's it for me. I can't do that anymore. Which we all sort of, you know, a lot of us, like in the makeup trailer, chatting about it, we're like, that's kind of lame of Charlie. Like, he's got a lot of responsibility with all of his younger siblings. Can he really, like, just say, like, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. But he did. That was the end of that. A lot of people thought I was going to come back and he was going to turn around, but I think that was the lead up for a new ongoing relationship. I don't remember. It was a long time ago, but he was very sweet. He actually had a kid at home. I think they had just had a baby, so he was exhausted. And so that's a funny little ironic twist about shooting that scene.
And I got to ask you about what it was like working with Woody Harrelson.
Oh, he's lovely. He's wonderful. That was really, really something else. That was my first feature film, and it was a really big deal. And he had just done Natural Born Killers, so he was a huge star. And I almost couldn't believe that I got the part. And it was so funny. I think it was. I had booked a commercial. So I had two different agents. I had a theatrical agent who sends you up on auditions for TV and film. And then I also had a commercial agent who sends you up on auditions for commercials. And they don't really talk to each other, and why should they? You know, if there's a conflict, you let them know. But generally, it's not an issue. And, you know, if I booked a commercial, let's say I'm shooting a commercial next Tuesday, I would tell my agent I'm shooting a commercial next Tuesday. So what happened was I had booked a commercial, but it was shooting on Saturday, which almost never happens. So I didn't bother telling my agent because they never did anything on Saturdays. So my agent calls me on Friday and says, you need to go by this casting director's office and pick up the script and she wants to pre-read you tomorrow on Saturday. And I was like, wait, what? I can't see her on Saturday. I'm shooting a commercial. They said, oh, okay. Well, why don't you go pick up the script and talk to her assistant and see if you can reschedule it for Monday. So I did that. And earlier that day, I had some other auditions I had makeup on. And then some friends of mine were in town staying at a hotel, so they had access to a pool. So they invited me over to their pool. So I had makeup on, and then I went to the gym, and then I went to the pool. So the makeup had, like, smeared all over my face. The mascara was, like, under my eyes like a raccoon. And I was wearing sweatpants, and my hair was all frizzed from being in the pool. And I just dropped. I thought I was just going to see the assistant. This is a note to burgeoning actors. You never know who you're going to see. So I walk in. Let's just look at like a drowned rat, and I'm talking to the assistant, but the door's open to the other office, and I hear her say, who is that? Tell her to come in. And I was like, oh my God. And it was the casting director. And so I walk in, my raccoon eyes and my frizzy hair and my sweatpants, and she says, you can't come tomorrow. I say, I can't. I'm shooting a commercial. I didn't think to book out because it was Saturday. She said, okay, well, here, take the script, and can you come in on Sunday? And I was like, sure, I can come Sunday. And she said, okay, I'm going to just bring you straight in to read for the director. Come in on Sunday and you can read for the director. And I was like, okay. And she said, oh, and he wants you to wear a skirt. He wants girls to wear skirts. And I was like, okay. So I left. So while I was shooting the commercial the next day in my downtime, I was reading the script, which was actually pretty good. And I was excited. It was really good. And she was a wealthy, Woody Harrelson was cast as this wealthy doctor who gets kidnapped. And I was his wealthy kind of trophy wife. And so I read that script and I got ready for the audition. And, you know, when you're going in for an audition, you don't want to wear like a costume, but you want to wear the kind of thing that character might wear. And you want to look as much like the character as you can. And for me, what I wear totally affects how I feel. If I'm wearing combat boots, I feel very different than if I'm wearing stilettos. Like, I walk different. My whole thing is different. I'm very sensitive to those kinds of things. So I didn't have a skirt that this, you know, wealthy wife would wear. This was the 90s. I had, like, grungy miniskirts. And none of that was going to work right, so I didn't wear. So I disobeyed, you know, the casting director's orders, which don't, another note to actors out there, don't do that. Do what she says to do. I think I wore jodhpurs, which I thought was a better choice for the wealthy wife. And I went in, and I remember waiting in the waiting room and seeing, I can't remember who it was now, maybe Laura Flynn Boyle? Maybe one of the actresses from Twin Peaks. I'm not sure, but I remember seeing a famous actress sitting there waiting to go in, which I was like, oh, okay, there's no way I'm getting this, but awesome, cool, I'm auditioning for this. I had been in LA for, like, you know, I was only 24 at that point, 23, 24, something like that. I had been there for like 2 years the most. And I went in and did the audition, and Michael Cimino was the director, and I didn't really know who he was. He's no longer with us. He's passed away, but he was the director of The Deer Hunter with Christopher Walken and Meryl Streep, and just amazing, amazing, dark, talk about nightmares movie, and that won all kinds of Oscars and stuff. But I didn't really, I mean, I just sort of kind of knew that. I didn't really have much of a... You know, I didn't really do my research back then. I do now. I obsessively research. But so I walked in and I did the audition, and he said, you didn't wear a skirt. And I said, I didn't have the right skirt for this character. There's no way she would wear any of the skirts I had. He said, okay. And then I left, and later that day I was at the gym Sunday night, and I went back and I checked my voice. My back then it was a, what was it called? An answering machine. And my agent said, you got the part. And I was like, oh my God. I just couldn't believe it. And that was a big, big, big deal. That was really, really super fun. And they traveled a lot. They shot a lot in the Southwest, which is one of my favorite parts of the world, in the desert and Monument Valley and all of that. Really beautiful. I shot all in LA. It's actually one of the few jobs I've had that shot in LA. And it was so fun. And, you know, really, really a big deal being on a big budget. That was a Warner Brothers film. And it was really a good time. And Woody Harrelson, to answer your question finally, it's a long-winded answer. He was really fun to be with. He's a class act. He's a good guy. We were also, that film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival. So we were at Cannes together, eating French fries and drinking champagne. It was really, really a good time. And he was the real deal, too, in terms of he's a real environmentalist. And I remember he used to drive the makeup artists crazy because he would tell them to stop using so much hairspray or tell them to turn off the air conditioners in the makeup trailer, which, you know, any makeup artist can tell you means everyone's going to start melting. But he was, you know, he was walking his walk way back then.
You had mentioned earlier, just briefly as we're wrapping up here, back to Baltimore, the Charm City Fringe Festival. And I know you premiered your own piece there a few years ago. I'm curious as to whether you think we'll ever see the trial of Hannah Porn become a film.
Uh-huh. Oh, my God, that's so interesting. I love that idea. I'm not working on it right now, but it's still very much alive in me. And it's interesting, important stuff. It was a really weird film. Play. It was a play, and it was a mixed media kind of experimental play. It was the first play I've ever written and or directed, and it won the Best of the Fringe Festival, which is pretty exciting. It was it really jumps around and bounces genres, and it sort of starts off as a TED Talk, and like imagine the TED Talk and you're at the TED organization and everybody in the whole entire place drops acid and goes on a crazy wild trip. That might be, if that's a genre, that was the genre. It starts off as a TED Talk and spirals off, and there's a dance number and there's little short films and all kinds of stuff. So I'm not quite sure how to make that into a film. The closest thing that I've seen, so it's certainly genre bending, busting. The closest thing that I've seen to something like that would be Vice, which I thought was such an amazing film. And I can't think of another film that kind of broke the fourth wall, broke the narrative, broke so many rules. That's how I would have to do it. And I'm not quite sure how to do that yet. But I'll keep you posted.
All right.
How about that?
Yeah, well, if it ever comes to pass, let me know.
Okay.
Well, like we mentioned before, your latest film project is What Death Leaves Behind, where you star as Dr. Kathleen Brady. Alexander Tidings, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
All righty, you have a good day now.
Okay, you too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was my conversation with actress, writer, and director Alexandra Tidings. She stars in the new film, What Death Leaves Behind. That about does it for me today. Stay tuned for my next episode, which will feature actress Grace Park and band Strange Breed. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.